Do you trust him?
Trust.
But does he trust you?
He's in the suspicion business. He can't trust anybody.
But they all are. How could anybody sneak in and fool?
Maybe nobody did.
Then...
maybe there's another CIA. Inside the CIA.
This is Bristol. It's Friday afternoon, and welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's Labour councillor for Frome Vale, Nicola Bowden-Jones, who's also a mental health specialist. Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers is here too. In the second hour, an abortive US attack on oil-rich Venezuela, an act of war. Like the regular Israeli acts of war, now bombing Syria. But these attempts of our so-called allies to start wars, these war crimes, are going virtually unreported in the London media. And Germany issues what some have called a declaration of war there against the European Central Bank. What does this mean for much-needed Eurozone bailouts and, of course, the future of the European Union? And a BBC news report that dawned chorus day last weekend, but they didn't report on the news International Press Freedom Day. Was their former employee George Orwell right about them being the Ministry of Truth, a clear and present danger to the nation? And the real VE Day behind the BBC hype, betrayal and victory on the 8th of May 1945. First, the atom bomb, evidence emerging over the last two or three years through official documents and the discovery of radioactive material in Germany that the Nazis tested an atomic bomb in October 1944, 9 months before the Manhattan Project's Trinity test on the 16th of July 45. Then the deals done by Churchill, Roosevelt and Truman for $1 billion in looted wealth, for Nazi enriched uranium, for experimental data from barbaric human testing, all carried out through the working to death of human prisoners in Hitler's so-called Untermensch. And the greatest betrayal, perhaps, of all, the aid given by the Allied leaders to a covert financial Fourth Reich of banksters and transnational corporations, the SS in suits and their supporters, an international mafia directing an international NATO Bilderberg mafia even unto this day, some say. And finally, on VE Day, whatever happened to Winston Churchill's finest hour speech about Britain standing up to the threat to Christian civilization, when Christians sometimes are now prosecuted through the British courts for practicing what they preach? That's all in the second hour. So, joining me to review this week's news, it's Labour councillor from Frome Vale, Nicola Bowden-Jones. Hi, Nicola. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello. Thank you, Tony.
Now, first of all, Nicola, how's things going? How's the council managing to function? First of all, I suppose, under the problems of the lockdown and social distancing, are council meetings actually happening? Is democracy chugging along fine?
Yes, we're having meetings by Zoom and they're proving very effective. One thing I will say, we haven't quite worked out yet how to involve the public in these meetings, but certainly internal meetings are happening and they're happening very well and very often.
I mean, surely, for example, you could live stream these meetings and the public could then actually do live comments alongside. I mean, quite a few people seem to be able to cope with that without too much trouble.
Yeah, some of the meetings are being live streamed. Like I said earlier, I think we've got a problem really in how we get feedback from the general public. I think that's something we really need to work at. I don't know whether people find it easier to stage questions so that they've got prepared answers, but I do think there needs to be a bit more spontaneity in terms of how we engage with members of the public.
What about the mayor? He's been doing these live Facebook chats and members of the public, he's answering their questions there.
Yeah.
Well, so, I mean, surely that's something that hasn't really been happening much in the past. He's done a few of those, but he's doing them fairly regularly now.
I think he has done some in the past. You know, we got an election in a year's time. So I think it's a really good idea that we do some of those things.
I mean, what about, you mentioned the election there. What about this whole idea? We're supposed to have had an election yesterday. And if the people in your part of the city in Frome Vale weren't happy with you, they would have voted you out yesterday.
Well, actually, I wasn't standing in Frome Vale, so they wouldn't have had the chance to vote me in anyway. So that they've got to put up with me for an extra year. I recognise that. And I really want to make sure that they get the best service they can from me, because I think that's really important. They haven't had a choice about me being their councillor for another year. So, you know, I think I've got to honour that and do what I can to support them.
I mean, isn't there quite a serious problem here, though? If we've had elections delayed for a year, that simply means for this next year, we don't actually have democracy in Bristol.
You could argue that. And, you know, it would be healthy, I think, at some point to revisit some of the decisions that were made in the council, because they were made in the understanding that there would be a new term of office for maybe the mayor and other councillors. But democracy is not just about voting in elections, is it? It's all the other ways people get to contribute to decision making in the city and have a voice.
Well, and also, yes, and have a voice, which we don't have on FM anymore, which is a great pity. We're still doing what we can to get BCFM's managing editor Pat Hart to allow these programs to go out on FM, but at the moment he's decided it's just too dangerous, because if he gets complaints he will then have to deal with them through Ofcom. But anyway, that goes on, that struggle to get back onto FM. But look, I mean, at the end of the day, Nicola, for example, in France a couple of weeks ago they had local elections there. Why can't we have them?
I think there's an electoral commission that have decided that, and it's about social distancing. You know, how do we do door knocking? How do we talk to people? How do we gauge what their interests are? All those things are really tricky to do, and I think it's a lot safer if we just hold these elections off for a year.
Well, say, for example, you can reach constituents through the media, for example, through the newspapers, through the radio.
We can reach some of the constituents that way, but there's an awful lot of people who don't have access to those things. I mean, you know, one way isn't the answer. You need to try lots of different ways.
And what about actually voting? I mean, what you could easily do, I mean, I'm not talking about you personally, but it doesn't seem to me to be rocket science to be able to hold an election within rules that don't endanger people. Say, for example, you know, you have social distancing and queuing at polling stations. You could quite easily sanitize ballot papers without too much trouble, and you could arrange the count, you know, so that people are certain distance. I can remember when I was a candidate, a Green candidate in Clifton years ago, I actually got the head of legal services come over to me and tick me off for being less than 2 metres away from the person doing the count. And he said I would be expelled from the building if I got any closer. So it seems to me that, you know, with some of the rules that exist at the moment for the counts and for paper elections, that we could do that within the rules of social distancing, and that possibly this is just an excuse not to have an election for people that want to stay in power.
Tony, I'm wondering if those rules weren't about electoral rules, but were about your personal hygiene. I'd just like to say.
Actually, I can tell you what it was about is they said that candidates were not allowed to physically get any closer than 2 metres to people actually doing the count. And it wasn't my personal hygiene, thank God for once.
The last time I attended a local authority count, it lasted 3 days. Would you really want to inflict that sort of thing, plus all the social distancing difficulties onto people? We'd probably be there for 2 months. But seriously, it does stop campaigning, and you'd end up with an election which isn't really about politics. So, you know, we've got to do this thing and delay it for a year. But I do think there is a case for looking at some of the decisions that were made in the council on the assumption that there would be an election this year. So there is a case
for that. Which of those decisions do you think, you know, stands out as something that the cancellation of the election has made a difference to then?
Well, off the top of my head, I think councillors' allowances, that needs to be revisited.
So are councillors getting more allowances or less now?
There is going to be an increase.
I mean, I've got in front of me Marvin Rees's April 2019 re-election statement, which is what the local parties, Labour parties, approved so that he could be the candidate in this election. That didn't happen yesterday, but will happen in a year's time. I mean, he's saying, for example, that in that statement, he promises, he's saying, we're reducing City Hall senior management and freezing top pay. Well, he hasn't frozen top pay at all, has he? He's actually increased his own pay by, I think it's around about 12, 13%, by £9,000.
He may not consider that to count as top pay.
I mean, all the other members of the cabinet too, also their pay has increased. I mean, what we've seen in other parts of the world, certainly I've, you know, come back in the last couple of weeks from New Zealand where their cabinet did the total opposite. They said, well, because of all the hardship we are putting people through with our lockdown rules, we're going to take a 25% drop in pay. Whereas here in Bristol, we've got the opposite. We've got the mayor and the cabinet all saying they're going to pay themselves more.
I mean, we have seen a reduction in the number of senior directors, but, you know, you're absolutely right. There are companies across the UK where people are taking a 20% cut in their salary to sort of replicate the people that are being furloughed. So those things are going on.
Marvin's statement, which was leaked to me, also, I mean, it's up there online at thisweek.org.uk, and I'll put it up again this week. I mean, because it is quite, I think, you know, when we elect politicians, we just need to make sure they're actually doing what they say they're doing, and they've done what they say they've done. Because one of the things that Marvin says in his statement is that he's proud to have secured the future of all of Bristol's libraries. Well, most people in the city would argue that he tried to close the libraries, and it's actually only campaigning by other councillors, other parties, that those libraries stayed open, Nicola.
Now, that's an example of democracy in action, Tony. But, you know, it wasn't Marvin who decided to give himself a pay rise. It was actually a full council meeting that was held just before the complete lockdown. So I just wanted to raise that as a
okay, point. Yeah, and also, I mean, the other thing, of course, is that this lockdown, was it before? Yeah, but the question is, was it before or after the decision to extend to cancel the elections and to extend everyone's tenure for another year?
I think it was made before the decision to postpone the election, because I think that happened afterwards. So I think, you know, people started talking about only having meetings if they were absolutely necessary, but we didn't realise what the full picture looked like. So it's we've got further into it that we've realised actually we can't do this, and that's what's happened.
So, I mean, essentially the decision was made on the basis that it would be a newly elected mayor, but then within a couple of weeks or so, maybe a week even, the decision was made to cancel the elections for a year and postpone them for a year. But also in Marvin's statement, he says that he's fully funded a £40 million council tax reduction scheme. Well, Mark Wright from the Lib Dems pointed out that that also wouldn't have happened if it hadn't been for very strong campaigning from other parties, the Lib Dems in particular, to make sure that the council tax reduction scheme carried on. I mean, this is one of the incredible things about this is that
I think it was the Labour Party that were really clear on the council tax reduction scheme. It wasn't, you know, Bristol Council or the Bristol Labour Party who decided to postpone the election. It was national government, so we can't take the credit for that sensible decision as much as we'd like to. But I certainly don't think it was the Lib Dems who were behind.
Okay.
Behind the scheme. So, we'd like to take credit for a lot of the good work that the Labour Party does.
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously, Mayor Marvin Rees is not the Labour Party, even though he represents the Labour Party. Some of the decisions that he makes, there is a little bit of kickback from the party itself, obviously. Another thing that Marvin talked about in his re-election statement was investing £90 million in tackling fuel poverty. Well, of course, quite a lot of that has gone into this, well, many would call a dead duck company called Bristol Energy, which the council just seems to be throwing more and more money into, good money after bad. What's your thoughts about Bristol Energy and, you know, whether that's actually good value for money for council taxpayers?
Well, Bristol Energy was started by the Lib Dems, and actually we're in a position now where we're saying we need to look at whether it's feasible, but we need to study the evidence to make decisions and not go with our sort of how we feel. So that's where we are at the moment. But, you know, we are spending money at the moment to help us with this coronavirus and the impact it has on people. We're going to have to completely review the council's expenditure at some point. We have been promised money from central government. I don't know how that's going to trickle through. But all the things that were promised before the coronavirus outbreak, they all need to be looked at again. You can't be held to promises you made because it's a new world we're living in now and we need to respond appropriately. And I think the Labour councillors will be really responsible in taking all those things into account.
Now, I'm glad you brought that up because Marvin Rees has said we need an extra £60 million from central government to pay for the policies which central government have brought in with the virus. The big news this week, Nicola, is that we've seen the resignation of Neil Ferguson from Imperial College, the guy that did the modelling, which really changed the decision. OK, so initially Boris Johnson said was going for a more of a Sweden approach where you allow your young people to catch the disease. You don't have such a strict lockdown. And it was Neil Ferguson's Imperial College report that convinced the cabinet to go for having a lockdown. Now, he this week has been sacked for actually not apparently, anyway, not even believing in his own report because he had a married woman come over to his house twice to break the lockdown conditions. Anyway, what do you make of this policy, central government policy? It does now seem that even the person that convinced the cabinet to go for the lockdown didn't really believe in it himself.
That's really interesting, Tony, because you've been talking about all these conspiracy theories that relate to the VE celebrations. And if you look at how poorly our government is behaving now, it makes you wonder what went on all those years ago. I mean, I wouldn't trust anything that comes out of a Tory MP's mouth. And I'm disgusted at watching them on the telly every single day when we've got nurses and doctors who are dying because they haven't got the resources they want to care for the people that need to be cared for. It's absolutely hideous. And people voted for the Conservative Party in December expecting them to take care of us. Well, they haven't. And we've just seen a complete load of lies and exaggerations by the Conservative government. So I'm absolutely appalled by it. And I hope people really do start to think about what they're voting for in general elections, because we got the highest death rate in Europe, you know, and it's just not acceptable. People voted for that, though. They voted in December. So the council stands to lose £80 million from loss of income, and that's from council tax, rents and parking charges. Now, somehow we have got to make that money, recoup that money in some way. And I think Marvin's absolutely right in holding national government to account because he wants some money off them. We shouldn't be paying for that. It should be coming from
some... Sorry, I said it was 60 million. You're telling me it's actually 80 million. That I mean, this is this is the relationship with Westminster. I mean, you're having to do what Westminster says, but then they're saying, well, you're going to have to find the money to cope with it yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's really interesting because so much was promised at the beginning that, you know, you wonder actually what if that's going to still be available. It's easy to promise things and it's different to deliver. And we haven't seen much delivery on anything, on testing, on uniforms, or, you know, so I can't see it's going to be any different with money.
No. Okay. So, I mean, it does seem as if the government hasn't really thought this policy through. Let's come back to Neil Ferguson and his resignation, because this is almost a kind of grenade going off at the middle of the lockdown policy. Can we be certain that this policy is the right policy when the guy behind it didn't believe it in himself and has now been sacked?
Look, I think this is the science that we need to think about and not the scientist. I mean, when you look at all the policies that were in the newspaper the day after this was discovered, it was the Sun newspaper called it something like Trousers Down. I mean, they use that headline for everybody that gets caught out. At the end of the day, we're people and, you know, he was in a position, he should set a good example. We're all finding this difficult, I think, this lockdown, but just because he's been caught in this compromising position, it doesn't mean the scientific facts that he's been presenting to us aren't accurate. We do need to think about that.
Okay, well, we'll be talking a bit more about some of those and maybe what you might call conspiracy theories. I would say necessarily actually we need a good broad selection of opinions, particularly from scientists and from emergency doctors, which we'll be hearing from later, because the science doesn't seem to be being teased out properly by the London press for us at all. Anyway, let's go back to talking about the funding shortfall for cities like Bristol, the idea that council taxpayers are effectively being told they've got to bail out central government's decisions, even though people haven't necessarily got any money to pay that council tax. It does seem as if this is really an attack on local democracy, an attack on local government, an attack on Bristol, an attack on Marvin Rees and all of our councillors who are trying to make ends meet in the city. So let's have a listen now to Prime Minister's questions this week, where we hear about the city funding shortfall across the country.
We now come to the final question from Lillian Greenwood. Lillian Greenwood.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Community Secretary has rightly recognised that council workers are the unsung heroes of this crisis and promised to give local authorities the resources they need. But my city faces a gap of up to £55 million as a result of extra costs and lost income. Our communities bore the brunt of austerity. They cannot carry the burden of coronavirus. Will he give all councils a cast iron guarantee that they won't be asked to do so?
Prime Minister.
Well, I thank her very much, and she, you know, she's absolutely right, as anybody knows, to draw attention to the difficulties, the straitened circumstances, the pressures that local councils have been under. And that's why we put the extra £3.2 billion in immediately to help them cope. And she should know, by the way, that Nottingham, her own city, has already had an extra £19 million to help deal with the pressures of coronavirus. And certainly that is by no means the last of the support that we will be giving to our fantastic frontline council workers who, as she rightly says, have borne so much of the brunt in this crisis.
Well, £3.2 billion, Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister's mentioning there, is first Prime Minister's questions facing the new Labour leader Keir Starmer. Nicola, have we seen any of that £3.2 billion in Bristol yet?
Yeah, I think it's about 25 million. But, you know, what we're doing is we're getting money for extra costs, but we're not getting any money to replace the income that we've lost, and that's really important.
Well, OK, so he's saying that there's going to be more coming down the line. Let's keep a watching brief on that. Do you think we can trust Boris?
No. That's the polite version of my answer.
Let's just bring Martin Summers in here, because there is a serious problem with council finances, Martin. I think it's, you know, it almost seems as if that this is surreptitiously or maybe just by neglect an attempt to neuter city councils and to literally bankrupt them.
Well, I think the problems are objective, as Nicola's just pointed out. It's not so much the expenditure side, although that's obviously a problem. It's the income side of councils is also being cut to pieces as the economic shock of coronavirus gets going. It's hardly started yet. It's going to roll through the economy. And ultimately, a crisis like this, the only real answer is for the state, nationally and locally, to take command of the economy. The private sector is about to collapse. But of course, the Tory government doesn't believe in that. They've ended up doing it because there's no other option, but they don't actually believe in it. And we're going to see tensions developing as we go forward between the right-wing ideology of the government that the private sector should be doing things and the reality that in a situation like this, it can't. And of course, you might see a change. I mean, Boris is such an ideological chameleon. He could decide that he's going to be the Tory that's in favour of big government, as he previously mused. He could be a Brexity Hezza, Brexity Heseltine. But of course, in actual fact, his party is wedded to the bailout, for example, of the financial services sector, which should just be allowed to collapse now. In the US, they've bailed out the banks again and all the major corporations. They should have nationalised them, not bailed them out. And I mean, the same issues are going to rise here.
What we've been hearing from Nottingham and from Nicola here and from Bristol's Mayor Marvin Rees is that potentially we could be looking at the virus outbreak as a excuse or reason to massively diminish the power of local government and the democracy that we all vote for every year.
They've been at war with local government for years. And of course, they're now forced to come up with some kind of money for an emergency situation. But of course, what really needs is a complete rebalancing of the fiscal state. So we should go back to land-based taxation for local authorities. Things like the rates, for example, which are still there in Northern Ireland because they didn't dare to remove them in the 1980s. We're going to need wealth taxes. You can't just run everything on deficits, although deficits are fine. The idea that we can't have a deficit, we've just proved that you can. And that the Tories have just thrown their own textbook out of the window and said, oh, yes, we can spend money when we want to, which was always true. But, of course, ultimately, you can't just spend money. You've got to raise it as well. And the obvious place to raise it from is from the financial services sector that was bailed out in 2008 and is being bailed out now. Ultimately, you bail out the people and allow the financial services sector to collapse. Though, ultimately, looking forward, you could see a situation where you have essentially the financial services sector run as a public utility and the modern, what we thought of as modern financial services just disappears. Now, the Tories are going to have to face into this abyss. They're not going to do the right thing. I'm pretty certain they aren't. But nevertheless, that is the choices that they face.
We're going to look now at Sunday's coming announcement in 2 days' time of what the route out of lockdown is likely to look like. Very difficult to predict, but I mean, 2 weeks ago on this program, there was a traffic light report which was leaked to the Daily Mirror and one or two other newspapers where they're saying that there's going to be a red phase, an amber phase and a green phase in the relaxing of the lockdown over the next few months. So that suggested 2 weeks ago, which we covered on this program, the red phase, which it predicted for the 11th of May, which of course is the bank holiday Monday just coming. Small non-residential shops can reopen, it said. Hairdressers can reopen, thank God. Lucky we're not on video today because we could all compare each other's dreadful haircuts or lack of haircuts. Warehouses apparently are going to reopen again, although I'm quite certain many of them already have. You can see on industrial estates, there's quite a lot of lorries back on the roads going across the channel, etc. Nurseries are officially allowed to reopen again, and travel will be possible but discouraged. That seems to me to be pretty much what's going on at the moment. I had to make a trip, an essential trip to London yesterday to visit very elderly relatives, and that was quite interesting to see on the motorway. I would say roughly something like a third of the normal traffic. Definitely people seem to be coming back out onto the roads and onto the streets and into the parks, etc. Lots of very busy parks in London, with the weather being particularly nice as well. But it does seem as if this is maybe the thing which is going to be announced on Sunday with the relaxation on the 11th of May into the red phase. Then apparently on the 25th of May, there may be an amber phase. And obviously the dates here are flexible. Boris can choose them. Small businesses will open up, up to 50 staff, social distancing. Some of those measures are lifted. I'll put a link up to the graphic, which was produced on the Mirror by the Mirror 2 weeks ago. And then a green phase on the 15th of June. Weddings and funerals can then take place with more guests. Theatres and cinemas will open with social distancing. Pubs will open with restrictions on the 15th of June. So we'll see if that is what they stick to. I mean, if this programme is what they stick to, it does rather make you wonder why they couldn't have told us all this 2 weeks ago. But let's have a listen now to Prime Minister's questions this week. The first one, where Keir Starmer was facing Boris Johnson, the new Labour leader, facing the Tory leader back after his spell in hospital and his paternity leave. And Starmer asks Boris this week about what he thinks life after lockdown is going to be like. Are we prepared?
Keir Starmer again.
Mr. Speaker, I was going to come to the plan. I'm grateful to the Prime Minister for that indication. There are millions of people on furlough, as the Prime Minister knows, millions with children at home struggling with caring responsibilities. If they're to return to work, and if their children are to return to school, they need reassurance. I think we can all feel that, reassurance that it'll be safe to do so. And that means they do need to know what the government's plan is for the next stage. So will the Prime Minister give them that reassurance by setting out his plan as he says he will? And will he come to this House on Monday to present that plan and have questions across the House?
Mr. Speaker, I will of course undertake that there will be a statement to the House, as you, Mr. Speaker, and the House would properly expect about what we propose tonight. So I just want to explain to the House as a courtesy why it's happening on Sunday, Mr. Speaker. I'm sure you'd be interested to know that. The reason for that is very simple, we have to be sure that the data is going to support our ability to do this. That data is coming in continuously over the next few days. We'll want, if we possibly can, to get going with some of these measures on Monday. I think it would be a good thing, Mr. Speaker, if people had an idea of what's coming the following day. That's why I think Sunday, the weekend, is the best time to do it. But of course, the House will be fully informed and the House will have the full opportunity to debate and interrogate me or the government on that matter.
And hopefully in the future it will be to the House first.
Yeah, so a statement to House of Commons on Monday and a discussion about the way that the lockdown is apparently the first stage to relaxing things a little bit. Nicola, he's talking there, he's saying, well, actually, we're going to be having a very close look at the statistics up until Sunday, so we know that what we announced for Monday is going to be the right thing to do. But there are quite a lot of questions about the statistics, the death rate statistics that have been coming through, and it's quite clear that the more that gets tested, the more people will be testing positive for COVID-19.
Yeah. I mean, I never thought that Boris Johnson was fit enough to lead the country anyway, but, you know, we've got a man who's not really very well, and I don't think he's in a position to be doing what he's doing at the moment. And I really don't think that they're making very good decisions. I don't think they're in anybody's interest. We've got over 500 people dying daily from this virus, and we're not in a position to relax any of the rules. We're not testing people properly. We still haven't got proper equipment. You know, we can't make decisions to send children back to school.
You said there, hang on, Nicola, because you just said 500 people a day dying of this virus. Well, most clinicians would argue, actually, no, they're not dying of COVID-19. They're dying with COVID-19. So it's a contributing factor. And the statistics aren't incredibly clear, but they're saying roughly around about 75%, possibly 80% of those that are dying have got underlying health conditions where actually COVID-19 hasn't killed them, but it's tipped them over the edge. So there is quite an important distinction there, I think.
I don't know. If it was a relative of yours that had died, you know, would you really be asking about the distinction? So we've got people dying. The rest of us have been isolating. I don't think it's the right time to send people back to work. We don't really understand enough about this virus as well. I mean, at the moment, we've got double the death rate. That's what we're dealing with, double the normal death rate. So do we do nothing and continue to allow people to die, or do we do something about it? We haven't sort of conquered how we manage the virus, and already we're talking about meeting the needs of the economy. Now, I think people need to come before the needs of the economy, and, you know, we'll sort that out later.
Well, I think you're absolutely right about the increased death rate, but not all of those people have been dying with the virus. There's quite a lot of extra people that have been dying as well with no coronavirus symptoms at all. So let's have a look at that in a little while. But let's stay on the economic factors for a minute. And another thing that came up at Prime Minister's questions this week was the idea of universal credit or a universal basic income taking up millions more people's incomes, ensuring that people don't starve, that you know, rents can be paid, electricity bills can be paid, and that sort of thing. So let's have a listen to that question now.
We go across to Murray Black. Murray Black.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Since the government are refusing to even discuss universal basic income, I was glad to see them at least recognise the need for an increase in universal credit entitlement. However, there's been no such increase announced in employment support allowance. So I want to ask the Prime Minister what plans he has for a similar increase in ESA, and if not, can he explain why he feels people who are sick or have a disability require less support at this time?
Prime Minister.
As she knows, what we have done is remove the 7-day waiting time for ESA, and I'm glad, though, that she pays tribute to the big increase in universal credit, another £1,040, benefiting 4 million families across this country, a total investment of £7 billion. But I think what everybody wants to see is not just people taking universal credit, but as I've said now several times, what they want to see is a careful, sensible programme attracting the widest possible support to continue to suppress the disease right down, but to allow our economy to start up again.
Well, that's Prime Minister Boris Johnson responding to a question about whether people on very low incomes and people who have had their livelihoods taken away are going to be able to survive. Martin, this whole idea of a universal basic income has been talked about for a long time. Do you think that this might be something to tip the government towards doing that? Or do you think the resistance is too much? They just don't like the idea that people will have the basic things that they need in life, the fundamental human needs, satisfied.
Well, if we brought in a universal basic income in response to the financial crisis of 2008, we would have been in a much better position to deal with this coronavirus shock. And of course, the other thing about the coronavirus shock people have got to realise is that the financial sector was collapsing in the United States in September before the coronavirus came along, and the Federal Reserve was already intervening in the repo market. Now, in other words, the financial crisis was going to happen anyway. The coronavirus has simply created a cover for the bailout of the banking system for the second time. And it's an unlimited bailout in the US. The Federal Reserve, which doesn't actually have the constitutional right to do this, but everybody's just waved it through, are now saying they'll print any amount of money to keep the financial services sector afloat. That is all basically based on the idea that the taxpayers will pick up the tab in the future. This shock, coronavirus plus economic shock, is the biggest since World War II, and there's going to have to be big thinking to deal with the consequences.
Well, Nicola,
things like universal basic income, definitely. But
Nicola,
the Tories are basically on the back foot on this one because they've tried to avoid all of this for years.
Nicola, councillors and MPs are actually in many ways on the front line when people are actually up against it, facing potential bankruptcy, eviction, and the rather, it seems, inadequate government response to that. What's your sense for what's going on in the city now with people on low incomes and those who are, you know, did have a reasonably safe income, particularly self-employed owners of small businesses, that are now finding that they need to sign on the dole, and that their plans they've made for the future, for their income, for their kids, for their family, etc., is in tatters?
I think it's a big concern, and I think, as Martin said, there needs to be some really big thinking around this. you know, people were struggling before, and people are still affected by benefit caps, for example. You know, the most vulnerable are going to be the most affected. We know that. But it's interesting that the clip that you showed just a minute ago, the last thing that Boris Johnson says is our economy must start up again. That's all he's interested in.
So that for small businesses, this is a serious problem. For many small businesses have found it impossible to actually get these so-called loans. I mean, one is amazed that the government has the audacity to give people loans in this sort of situation. Of course, they should be giving grants to businesses to carry on, since the government is responsible for their lack of income in a similar way to with the council. The former Bank of England Governor Mervyn King was on Newsnight this week talking about this particular problem that he's identified. He's very much in touch with people like the Federation of Small Businesses, etc. And they're saying that it's becoming, for many businesses, it's been totally impossible to access this money that the government say is there in order to keep them going. So let's have a listen to the former Bank of England Governor Mervyn King now.
The government's done its very best to come up with a scheme to help small businesses and the self-employed. But it doesn't seem to be the case that the businesses that need the money find it easy to speak to the banks and ask for loans under this scheme. They wouldn't be asking for loans under this scheme if it weren't for the virus. So I think, in a sense, the banks now need to act as agents for the government. This is a government scheme. If that means the government guaranteeing a higher proportion of the loan, so be it. But one way or another, the banks need to be able to put out more loans. And if it's not working, someone needs to get a grip on it.
So that's the former Bank of England Governor Mervyn King speaking on Newsnight, suggesting there, Martin, that the government hasn't got a grip on this scheme, although it's talking the talk about supporting small businesses, making sure that they can survive through this government-imposed lockdown, that they're not walking the walk.
Well, the obvious thing to point out is, why are the banks distributing the loans? The government could distribute the loans directly to small business. Cut out the banks. Why do you need the middlemen of the banks? But of course, we need the middlemen of the banks because that's the way the thinking goes. We have to have banks, and therefore we've got to work through the banks to work with small business.
The government could take that over for itself. If I can interrupt you, I think what Mervyn King is suggesting there is that the government are failing at the job, so we need to find another route that might possibly be the banks doing these loans directly.
No, the scheme as it stands, Tony, is that the government will underwrite loans from the banks, so that then the banks are supposed to administer the scheme. The government could take control of this scheme itself and cut out the banks. The whole idea that the banks have got to be involved is Tory think.
Nicola, what do you got to say to anyone with small businesses, shops, etc., self-employed, that are really desperate for loans or grants in order to keep going because they're going to fold up? I mean, this is another aspect to all of this, isn't it? Big business is doing very well out of all of this. We've got lots of extremely powerful transnational companies, the likes of Amazon, people like that, are having a field day, massive increase in profits, in revenues, and yet the small people, small medium enterprises, are being really hard hit by this. What have you got to say to them?
It's a real worry, and I'm really worried about this because, you know, you're talking about people that we live with, people that we know, our friends, etc. And I think the government really does need to step in and do something about this. But I think the role of the banks in this is to devolve any blame from the shoulders of the government, so there's someone to blame. But, you know, we have a responsibility to help retail, pubs, restaurants, etc., etc. And we need to shop and spend our money as responsibly as we can to support them. So we all need to come together and think about how we're going to support SMEs in the future. Otherwise, we could end up with a situation where parts of Bristol and the rest of the country become ghost towns, and we don't want that. So we all have a role to play, I think, in moving forward. But the government are the people that need to step in and support SMEs, not expect someone else to take on that role because it's no one else's responsibility.
So we've also got, I mean, one of the things, particularly, Nicola, reason I asked you on is because you're a primary mental health specialist as a day job. Can you just tell us a bit about, you know, what that means, what you do?
I'm a primary mental health specialist, so I work with children and families where there are mental health worries to try and look at finding solutions to some of the problems that people have.
Without naming names, just give us an example of the sort of interaction that you might have with a family and who you're actually working for.
So I'm employed by the National Health Service, and I work for children's social care.
So yeah, just give us an idea of so a typical, well, not a typical day, but the sort of way you can help, what outcome you might get for a family.
So, for example, there are lots of concerns about how children reintegrate into school. So we might be working with schools to think about how they can start to re-engage children in a way that's not going to cause them any emotional harm. So that might be one of the ways I engage.
Well, emotional harm, of course, that's something that the church used to deal with years ago. I suppose if you people felt that they were having problems emotionally, that they would go and talk to the local vicar. Now, it's mental health specialists like you they speak to. Do you think that's fair to say that you're doing a job which maybe a century ago would have been done by the church?
Well, the church did a lot of things a century ago that it doesn't do today, although I think the role of the church is changing. In Bristol, it does quite a lot. But, we lived in different communities 100 years ago, and that was before Margaret Thatcher and the Tories came along and tried to break up the communities that we lived in. So, I think a lot of things have happened in the way that we changed the way that we live that have an impact on mental health.
I mean, I think there's many people, if someone had a mental health condition before the lockdown, it's likely to be exacerbated during and after it. What do you think, Nicola?
If you've got a mental health problem where it's easier to stay inside your house, then the lockdown might be easier for you to manage. So for some people, this might be, you have to rethink sort of whole spectrum of mental health, really. It's not about one size fits all, because some people will find it easier to live during the lockdown than other people will.
But I mean, you can't help but compare it to Julian Assange and his house arrest. I mean, this is a form of house arrest, isn't it? I mean, there's a lot of people, particularly if they're isolated and lonely, that this could tip them over the edge.
Yeah, there is that. And it's also a concern that, And we need to think about how we support people to make connections with other people, even though they're isolated and living in their homes.
Well, look, let's go back to Prime Minister's questions. Another emotional, I suppose, related, mental health possibly related story, and that is to do with burial services. And this question is particularly difficult for those who've lost loved ones and possibly not been able to see them on their deathbeds, then finding almost like a double whammy where there are all sorts of restrictions on burial services too. So let's have a listen to that question now.
We'll go across to Raymond Chisty. Raymond Chisty.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Like other colleagues, I'm absolutely delighted to see the Prime Minister back at the dispatch box and congratulating him and Carrie on the birth of their child. Prime Minister, my constituent, Jackie Potter, recently lost her husband, Ashley, who was 64. The family would like to bury Ashley with a small church service, applying social distancing. If Ashley were to be cremated, this would happen. But as he is being buried under current guidelines, that is not possible. Can this anomaly between burials and cremations be urgently addressed so that families of all faiths who want to bury their loved ones, applying social distancing and in a faith service, are able to do so?
Prime Minister.
Yes, indeed, Mr. Speaker. And I thank my honourable friends and I extend my deepest sympathies to the friends and family of his a constituent, Ashley, and we're asking councils to do exactly that, to help people to attend without breaching the rules on social distancing. And I'm sure you'd appreciate we think that's the right balance to strike.
So Boris Johnson there saying that there may be some sort of opening up of these services of some kind. Anyway, what are your thoughts, Nicola, about the emotions around something like losing a loved one and then having to cope with a whole load of what some people say are draconian measures, where they're quite prepared to do, say, an activity like a funeral service, a burial service, using social distancing, but being told, for example, that if it's a cremation, it can go ahead. If it's a burial, it can't.
I mean, losing a lost one can be, you know, one of the most difficult experiences that somebody goes through in their whole life. And sort of over time, we've developed a cultural way of getting through that. And now that's all changed. And we haven't really been given the opportunity to think about how we do that whole process differently. And I've seen some, you know, services online that people have attended. I think it's really sad. And, you know, we are talking about relaxing some of the rules. And I think that needs to be one of the rules that we think about, because not being able to grieve appropriately is, you know, not an acceptable form in terms of supporting people to get through this and, you know, deal with losing loved ones.
Yes, and also, I mean, funerals, to a certain extent, I've been to some that can be a kind of celebration of somebody's life.
Well, you know, people have really creative ways of expressing how they want to say goodbye or, you know, commemorate someone's life. There's lots of different ways that we go through this process. And, you know, I don't think the thinking has sort of really included a lot of things around that.
No, and also, I mean, humans characterise themselves as different to other creatures by actually making a big thing of this, and think we've done that throughout history. It's one of the things that anthropologists talk about. And now it's, for many people, it's being taken away. But before we get completely off this subject, there was an interview on the BBC's PM programme this week with the head of the Public Health Institute at Newcastle University, Alison Pollock, Professor Alison Pollock, talking about isolating the dying and elderly and the effect. She talks about it as a barbaric practice.
Yeah, I agree. I think it is barbaric. I mean, we've talked for years about how we treat our elderly. You know, it's BE Day plus 75 years today, and we're saying what a wonderful thing those people did. And I don't think that we are really acknowledging that in our everyday experiences. I've had people contact me to help to put some sort of hygiene standards into care homes and things. They shouldn't have to do that. We should be able to organise ourselves to look after people. So, you know, and we accept that elderly people are at risk of being isolated, and that's in our normal society. So how are those people going to feel now that we've got social distancing, people are frightened to go out? I would agree with what Alison Pollock's saying.
Well, let's have a listen to her now on on the PM programme on Radio 4 earlier this week.
There was an admission today of how tough it is for the extremely vulnerable to carry on shielding themselves, staying at home, often alone. Yeah. I mean, can people continue to do that without suffering ill effects, be that in terms of their mental health or their physical health?
Yes, this is an enormous hardship for everybody, but especially older people who may not have very much longer to live in their lives. And so, indeed, nursing homes now should be making arrangements so that you can have at least one member of the family visiting. I mean, that would be good for the individual, and there should be a designated member, and that's beginning to happen, for example, in New Zealand. I think this idea of people being in solitary confinement, which is like prison, and also dying on their own is inhumane and it's barbaric, and we've never had anything like this before in this country. It's really for this sort of epidemic, it's really quite barbaric.
So that's Professor Alison Pollock from Newcastle University, Martin, saying the idea of saying that there are rules now that if people are dying, that they are not allowed to see their family. This is the first time it's ever happened, according to Alison.
Well, I mean, as Nicola pointed out, we've been isolating old people anyway before all of this kicked in. There's been a problem with isolation and so on. I think as this goes on, we're going to have to develop rules to deal with these situations, and we're going to have to tweak them till we're satisfied with them, or probably we'll never be satisfied with them, because I don't see that this is going to end anytime soon. The idea that we've got in the Tory press that we're going to be going back to boom, boom Britain and getting Brexit done, I think that's for history. We're not going back to any of that.
So let's have a listen now to some, I suppose, what you might call conspiracy theories, Nicola. But this is doctors over in California. And I brought this clip in really because of Press Freedom Day last weekend, because their interviews, the press conference these emergency doctors did in the United States in California, was then removed from YouTube. Now, what I can only assume that one of the big TV networks who filmed the press conference decided to take a claim to remove it. But anyway, what they're saying is actually really, I think, very important when it comes to understanding some of the facts and figures to do with the science behind the lockdown, and also hearing from people who are actually on the front line, emergency, running, as I understand it, a private emergency clinic in California. So let's hear from Dan Erickson now, and he's talking about how the lockdown hasn't—he doesn't believe—it's actually really affected the death rate a great deal. And this is from 2 weeks ago in California. Let's hear from him now.
Who has done lockdown and who has not done lockdown, and has it mattered?
Yeah.
So when I look at the data globally, I look at Sweden and I look at California, New York, and the U.S., and I say one locked down and one didn't. One let it run its course and one didn't. And has that affected the death rate? And the death rate has really been 150 per million for the United States and 200 per million for Sweden. Italy and Spain have 400 per million and they locked down, which means their death rate was higher. And there's a variety of factors for that. I don't want to simplify it, but what I'm saying is sheltering in place and locking down was supposed to, the point of it was to not overwhelm our hospital systems. Well, in Kern County, our hospital census is very low. As I talk to the CEOs, their ICUs have very few patients. Their ERs don't have patients. They have many beds open. And we're saying, okay, for 2 months, we sheltered, we locked down, we did what was required. Now I think it's appropriate to start easing up and allowing the medical system to bring all of its people back and function at a normal level, because it doesn't make sense to send doctors and nurses home.
Well, so he's finishing. That's Dan Erickson, doctor in California there. Obviously, this is the figures and for California. But he's also saying, and we'll hear again another clip now, and we can comment on it afterwards, where he's saying here that he believes actual infection rates of the virus are 65 times higher than the official figures in the United States. So it looks as if, and there could be a similar thing going on here, where many, many people have got the virus over the last few months, and it simply hasn't been detected. So let's have a listen again to Dan Erickson talking about infection rates, the ones he found through testing himself and the official government figures, and the anomaly between the two.
The CDC requested us to use a screening of cough, fever, shortness of breath, which is what we did. And right now, we've done just under 6,000 tests, and we're getting about a 7% positive infection rate for COVID for Kern County, which has just under a million people. Our study was initially not randomized, meaning we were selecting who we were going to test. And then after a few weeks of that, we had a lot of people coming in who were requesting the test for a variety of reasons, and we had employers who said, hey, I need my employees tested to come back to work. So we started really testing everyone who needed a test, and so our numbers really started to climb. Initially it was 6.5, now it's 7%. So I'm reporting my data and comparing it to, for instance, Stanford. They're doing antibody testing in Santa Clara County, and they're seeing between 2.5 and 4.16% positive rate, which means that they have between 45 and 80,000 cases. Well, their health department reported 956. So this is 50 to 80 times the amount of positive cases in Santa Clara County. In Kern County as well, the amount reported is fairly low, and we're getting about a 7% positive rate. So the numbers are likely much higher in those two counties than was anticipated by the numbers at Public Health.
So that's Dr. Dan Erickson there, censored from YouTube. One does wonder what's going on. We can't hear him on the London media, the mass media, and now we can't even hear him on YouTube, on social media. Why is his voice being censored, one wonders, and it may be simply because what he's saying there, Nicola, and I'm not asking you to necessarily come up with an opinion on whether what he's saying is right or not, but he's suggesting that the actual infection rates from the virus may be 65 times higher than the official figures in the US. And I just wonder that, I mean, this is not just one order of magnitude, is it? It's almost two orders of magnitude completely wrong. And yet decisions are being made by central government in the US and in Britain based on these, what you might call lies, damn lies and statistics.
Mm. I know. I mean, we've got no way at the moment of really knowing how many people have been affected. And I understand there's not a reliable antibody test available either. So, you know, it's going to be a really long time before we've got any idea about how many people have really been affected by it. And I just say something about the other point about social isolation, because there was some comparison with Sweden. But, you know, Sweden's had recorded deaths of about 3,000, and neighbouring countries, Norway and Finland, well, Finland's about 255 and Norway's 217. That's quite a big difference. So I think there is an awful lot of evidence to suggest that social isolation is working. And, you know, we are using really crude screening tools like fever, cough, shortness and breath. Until we get a real understanding of who's been affected, we're not going to have any other helpful ways of dealing with this.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the basic things with the statistics is I would only take into consideration statistics that are looked at per measure of population. I mean, the idea of what is the total number of people who've died in one country doesn't mean anything compared to another country unless you're looking at it as a percentage of the population. I mean, obviously, more people have died in the US because it's bigger. You know, this is a real basic thing that many journalists don't seem to be even bothering with. But Martin, what do you make of what we were hearing there from the US? This censored clip from Dan Erickson, the doctor in California, saying that he believes from the actual tests he's done himself that the official figures in the United States, there's actually 65 times more people have had this virus than the official figures suggest.
Well, in South Korea, of course, they tested everybody and they've got a fairly good idea of who's got the virus, who hasn't got it. They tested people at random and they chased people up when they found that they were infected. What you've got in the US with a shambolic system is that they've no idea how many people have been affected. And of course, it raises the question that perhaps this thing didn't start in China at all. And it's been running around in the US for months. That's possibly something we can discuss in hour two.
And let's just look at the figures, the death rate figures per head of population, which I think is the thing that really makes sense.
Can I just make a point on that, Tony?
Yeah.
Don't forget that the virus spread. Some countries are not in the direct path of the virus. So it's not just a question of per head of population. It's per head of the people, numbers of people infected. Yeah.
And also, of course, some countries are, it seems, far ahead, many weeks or even months ahead of other countries. And they don't want to admit it. So they're saying that they're at the same stage of the virus, but they're not. Anyway, let's have a look at the death figures at the moment per head of population. This is I pulled these figures out a couple of days ago. The highest in Europe is Belarus with 2,000 per million of actually died, which is 0.2% of the population with coronavirus. In Belgium, the figure is very high. It's 690 per million. In Spain, it's 550. Italy, 480 people have died with COVID-19. The statistics say that Britain comes just below Italy, Spain, Belgium, Belarus at 420 people per million of population have died with COVID-19 on their death certificates. In France, it's 420 below Britain per million. Then comes Sweden at 280 per million, which is 0.03% of the population. Now, you know, once we start getting down to 400, 300 per million of population, this is starting to look much more like a very severe flu season. Germany has done the best of all, though. Whether it's to do with managing their statistics or whether it's their incredibly efficient healthcare system is anyone's guess. But the German figures are 100 people per million of population have died with coronavirus. So that is 0.01% in Germany have died. So the figures there, Martin, and I'm afraid we've just lost Nicola Bowden-Jones now. But what do you make of all these figures here?
Well, I think we've got to take all of the figures with a pinch of salt, because, of course, the reporting of these figures is different in each country.
Well, hang on, Martin, you can't take them with a pinch. The government is using these figures to decide what it's going to do on Monday and whether it's...
We've got to use the figures because you haven't got anything else to use. But you've got to recognise that the figures themselves are very much a rough estimate of what's going on. I mean, different countries have got quite different ways of reporting these things. And that, you know, you can't presume that one country's way of connecting the figures is comparable with another.
And we were hearing from the United States.
We can't draw some broad conclusions from what we're reading and what we're seeing.
But we were hearing from the United States.
It's still tentative.
We were hearing from the United States earlier, the figures there in one emergency doctor's surgery and the testing that he was personally doing, 85% more than actually the official government figures in the United States. So these are wildly inaccurate.
Well, they could be wildly inaccurate. This is the point I'm making. We're looking at them now, and the government's having to make decisions on the basis of what's in front of them. But, of course, we're essentially flying blind because this virus has, to some extent, taken people by surprise. And we can't presume that we know what it is. It's not a flu virus, clearly, for a start. So comparing it with flu really doesn't make much sense. So I think we've all got to recognise how provisional our knowledge is in these circumstances.
And what
we
about
can draw some conclusions, but we've got to recognise what we know.
What about developing nations? They may not.
Well, exactly. I mean, if you think about it, this virus is now spreading all over the world, and in some countries. There's no mechanism for measuring these kind of statistics at all. There's no proper healthcare system. So nobody really knows who's dying or how many of them. It's only developed countries which have got some kind of healthcare system which collect these kind of statistics effectively. And of course the US, although it is a developed country, has got an absolutely chaotic, fragmented healthcare system. Where the chances of them actually being able to cope with the situation are quite limited compared, for example, to Sweden, has got a very highly developed healthcare system and collects statistics probably as effectively as anybody can.
Germany
has done so well because, again, they didn't go for herd immunity. They went for lockdown and tracing. Tracing is the key to it. They didn't go for full lockdown in South Korea. They traced everybody. And then they know exactly how many people they've got. And in China, they've now reached the point where they're not getting any more infections. Of course, the lockdown may change that.
A very important matter, Martin, which is that some countries like the US and the UK, we've just heard this week that also France, there were cases of COVID-19 there well before even the outbreak was reported in China, that some countries may be much further into the spread of the disease than they realise, having had it spread even for months in their country before COVID-19 was even recognised.
Well, I think there's going to have to be an investigation into all of this about how it all started. And as you know, Tony, there's already recriminations going on with Pompeo and the Trump regime, if we can call it that, trying to pin the virus on the Wuhan Virological Laboratory via the Murdoch press, where then the intelligence services in the West, the Five Eyes, came forward and said, well, that's nothing to do with us. This is the Trump administration's, special advisors that have come up with this. And, of course, it was also, as Kevin Rudd, the former Australian Prime Minister, pointed out today, this is a leaked report, and therefore it is, in fact, illegal to be leaked. and it's been picked up by Murdoch's Australian Telegraph and so on. But in actual fact, what they're doing is this is a leaked report, and it's been leaked by the US administration. Now, has it been leaked deliberately? And if it's been leaked deliberately, did Trump give the orders for it to be leaked deliberately?
Well, there are lots of strategic leaks go on in our world, although the public aren't necessarily au fait as to which are actual real leaks. In fact, I tend to think that almost every time there's a leak, that somebody stands something to gain by it.
Well, exactly. I mean, it looks pretty clear that Murdoch has got together with Trump to push this so-called report, 15 pages, PDF, which links supposedly, according to the intelligence services of the West, to the Wuhan virus. But there's been pushback from the intelligence services, from MI6 and others who've been briefing The Guardian, that this isn't their report. Now, in other words, we're basically, you'd have thought in a situation like this with a red crisis on, everybody would be really, really scrupulous about sticking to the facts. But in actual fact, what we've got is political spinning going on. Well, and of course, that then leads to questions about what this virus is.
Yeah, well, one massive piece of political spin that's been going on is painting this idea of a vaccine as this sort of knight in shining armor charging across over the horizon to save us all from COVID-19, where actually we know that the Gates Foundation, who is pushing this virus vaccine as a solution to the virus around the world, was actually funding Neil Ferguson's department at Imperial College, which came up with the very overestimated the idea that 500,000 people in Britain were going to die of COVID-19, let alone with COVID-19. He is now being sacked. To a certain extent, that whole policy has been discredited because he wasn't actually following it or believing it himself. Although his reason, he said, was, Martin, and this goes back to what we were just talking about, that apparently he believed he'd had the virus and so couldn't contaminate anybody else, Neil Ferguson.
Well, I think you've got to, I mean, his personal peccadilloes have got to be extracted from the discussion. Whether he was right or not in his prognostications, you've got to remember that we have had a lockdown. What he was saying is if we don't have a lockdown, we're going to end up with 250,000 people dead. We've had a lockdown and we've still got, what we've got. So it's easy to throw accusations around. I don't think there is going to be a vaccine. So, and if there is one, I'm going to be very suspicious.
Well, one person who would disagree with you.
It takes quite a long time to develop vaccines.
Well, I know.
And if they just turn up with one, I'm going to be very, very suspicious indeed.
It's going to be the world record, apparently. In fact, there was a leak, wasn't there, at the presidential press conference 3 weeks or so ago, where one of the journalists was overheard saying, well, everyone here has been vaccinated. I mean, they're saying now that this was just a joke, but it did seem as if he was saying it. Is it feasible that actually there has been already a vaccine developed for this? And some
Well, what happened during the anthrax attacks after 9/11 was that senior US people in the establishment were all given anthrax antibodies. They were given it in advance before the anthrax attacks started. That's on the record.
So it's not impossible then that somebody somewhere has already developed this vaccine and people, elite, rich, powerful or whatever have already had it. Is that feasible?
Well, if Bill Gates does suddenly turn up with a miracle vaccine, that is the first thing that's going to cross my mind. But I have to say, just looking at it objectively, it's very difficult to develop vaccines for viruses. And if they've got one, I'll be surprised.
The other thing is, of course, is we're starting to talk here now about the possibility that this is a man-made virus or not. It certainly doesn't seem to behave like the normal common cold coronaviruses.
No, I mean, this issue of whether it is or not a biological weapon is something that can be discussed. But, of course, the mainstream aren't talking about that, except that they are, because the US have decided for their own political reasons that they're going to try and pin all the blame of this on China, and then they're going to sue China for damages. They're talking about $10 million for every US citizen that's died. And of course, the Chinese are just rolling their eyes and saying, well,
it's an obvious question to ask about this virus being so completely different to previous coronaviruses. And it's, you know, if the pubs were open, all the pubs would be alive with conversation about, is this a man-made virus, Martin?
Well, I think that the lots of people around the world are asking the question, is it a man-made virus? We had GRU colonel on the show the other week, the clip of him saying that their estimation is that it is. I am definitely disposed to think that it might be, but I don't think it's a Chinese virus. Why would they do this to themselves? Don't forget that the banking system in the US was about to collapse anyway, and this virus came along in China, their political rival and economic threat, and then suddenly they're able to bail out the banking system with no questions asked. Therefore, they've got a motive for doing it. Two motives.
Okay,
mess up the Chinese Communist Party's policy. Two, to bail out the banks, both of which they've done.
Anyway, somebody that did take on this whole possibility of having a vaccine was the Health Secretary Matt Hancock this week, speaking with the Deputy Chief Medical Officer Jonathan Van Tam at a press conference about not only the possibility of a vaccine, but also one question by a journalist from the Huffington Post was asked about the threat from the so-called anti-vaxxers, which is this term given to people who are critical of the benefits of vaccines. So let's discuss that after we've heard what Matt Hancock and Jonathan Van Tam have got to say about vaccines and anti-vaxxers.
We support the development of the vaccine, and you'll have seen the Prime Minister's excellent announcement today, and then that we also do the work to ensure that people can get access to the vaccine, starting with those who are most vulnerable. On the question of whether to make it compulsory, I think that the extent of the public's reaction to following the lockdown shows that we will be able to achieve very, very high levels of vaccination without taking that step. And so our task is to ensure that it is, in the first instance, we support the science as much as possible, because we can't assume there'll be a vaccine. There is no coronavirus vaccine yet for any of the existing coronaviruses, and this is uncertain science. We're proceeding on the basis that just such a huge proportion of the population are going to take this up because of the obvious benefits to individuals and their families and their communities and indeed the whole nation, that there'll be enormous demand for it as and when the science is safe to proceed.
Yes, thank you, Secretary of State. So just to stay on the vaccine question for a little longer, it is more likely than not that the first vaccines will be licensed in adults in the first instance. And therefore, one has to put some caveats around your question around children. And the other thing to say is that so far the epidemiological evidence is not showing us that there is a massive burden of disease or burden of mortality in children. It is actually completely at the other end of the scale. It is in the elderly. And so from that perspective, again, that's another caveat I'd add to your question about vaccinating children.
Right, I think we'll get back to you, Paul. Is that the scientists will get back to you.
Yeah, just one brief follow-up, Secretary of State. Do you have a message for those anti-vaxxers here and abroad when and if we do get a vaccine for COVID-19?
Well, I think there has been no greater demonstration in modern history that vaccines save lives than the need for a vaccine to save lives and to get the world going again following the outbreak of COVID-19. And we will only license a vaccine when it is both effective and safe, and when the independent regulators, if and when the independent regulators license a vaccine in this country, they will do so knowing that it is safe. And everybody should follow that. Everybody should follow that advice.
Well, that's a fascinating answer from Matt Hancock, the health secretary there, Martin, talking about the idea that the vaccine, he says there's no greater demonstration of the effectiveness of the vaccine than the need for the vaccine right now.
Well, I mean, that's clearly illogical, isn't it? I mean, we haven't got a vaccine. And if we had one, we'd then have to discuss whether people would take it or not. But we're not even sort of having one, are we?
It doesn't suggest that Matt Hancock has really thought this through, does it?
Well, no. And I think people can be critical of vaccine programs and the kind of pressures that are put on by pharmaceutical companies for vaccine programs to be conducted basically to make profit for the companies concerned rather than on medical need. And I think that's the issue that people need to address, is the whole process of deciding who gets. And of course, if vaccines are made compulsory, as they are often in developing countries, then the question becomes, well, who's benefiting? Who's profiting from this?
Well, I mean,
this whole crisis brings forward the whole idea that we should have medicine and health should be outside the marketplace. There should be no room for market economics in dealing with something like this.
Well, to be fair to the drug companies, they're saying, Martin, that they don't want to make profit from the vaccine.
Well, they may say that, but that's a load of rubbish. It's well known that Bill Gates has made massive profits from his investments in this area. And his not-for-profit corporations go around. He's the major funder of the World Health Organization. Now, I don't think that's acceptable that a billionaire is the major funder of the World Health Organization. And ultimately, World Health Organization should be a public body responsible through and accountable to the public. It shouldn't be funded by private enterprise. It's just wrong. It's a public-private partnership too far. And, of course, all of this then raises questions about what the hell's going on with vaccines. And I think there's, you know, the vaccines in principle may be helpful, but not if they're run by people who've got a vested interest or a hidden agenda.
Well, there's also a very important aspect to this, which is the Vaccine Act in the United States in the 1980s, which made it impossible for victims of vaccines, and other people who have been harmed by them, to sue the drug companies. The government basically in the US said, it's okay, you can sue the government instead. And the vaccine companies making the vaccines were so important that they didn't want vaccine companies to be damaged in private lawsuits by people who had been damaged themselves by the vaccines. So this is a legal anomaly that means that vaccines, if you're killed, hurt or damaged by a vaccine, you've got no real recourse in law except against the government, not against the vaccine manufacturers.
Well, that's right. So in other words, the power of the government is being used to protect the profits of private companies, which are run for personal profit, not for the benefit of humanity. I mean, you've got all these billionaires now giving their wealth. The Duke of Westminster gave £12 million to the National Health Service as a result of COVID-19. In actual fact, that money should have been taken off him as wealth tax, so that he doesn't get to give it as a gift and go on how wonderful he is to give us the money.
The other thing is, a lot of people have commented about the attacks over the last decade against Andrew Wakefield, striking him off. He has been a long-time campaigner, believing that the government should not be vaccinating as many people as they are. He's like the classic anti-vaxxer. And so, I mean, what some of the stuff I've been reading is saying, well, we always wondered why it was that Wakefield was being attacked in this way, even though he's making very important arguments suggesting that, I mean, one of the most important things he's shown is the poisons that are actually in some of these vaccines, things like mercury. Another thing that he's exposed is the fact that multiple injections of the vaccine are being done to newborn children, even though those multiple injections haven't been tested. The individual vaccines one by one, say the measles vaccine on its own has been tested, but it's never been tested as a multiple vaccination with five different vaccines all being injected at once. And this, I can remember going back to the Gulf War syndrome days, interviewing victims of multiple vaccinations and inoculations during the Gulf War, Martin, who came back completely broken people. Many of them died from Gulf War syndrome.
Well, all of these things need to be taken into account when we're thinking about vaccinating people. But I would suggest to you, the ultimate problem is the for-profit nature of the pharmaceutical industry. And ultimately, we can't be trusting of people who have basically got a vested interest in pushing vaccination, getting governments to make it compulsory, and then, of course, providing the money, because, of course, that's where the money comes from, taxpayers, for these people to make private profits, because they've got a vested interest in vaccinating. Vaccination should be a medical decision taken purely on medical criteria, not on any profit criteria at all. And they try to cover this up all the time. But basically, Bill Gates makes money out of vaccines. That's what he does. And he can pretend that he's giving money away through his not-for-profit corporations and trusts. And, of course, basically what he's doing is he's avoiding tax because he's put it into these not-for-profit trusts. The not-for-profit trusts go out and push for vaccines, and then the companies that he's invested in for profit provide the vaccines.
Martin, you've missed out
some.
You've missed out a very important factor there, one of which is that many of these trials that Bill Gates has been doing of vaccines over the last 30 years or so in different parts of the world have either given people a disease that they didn't have, for example, polio, have left them sterilized, or killed people around the world. And in fact, Bill Gates's vaccine programs have been actually kicked out by governments around the world, many of them.
That's right. He was kicked out of India because his polio vaccine led to people getting polio. Now, of course, a more sinister aspect of this may be that he wants people to die off because he's basically in favour of reducing the human population. We know that. But ultimately, you've got to distinguish that from the wider question of would a vaccine be a helpful thing in a particular medical emergency? And that's a medical question. But Bill Gates ain't a doctor. He's a billionaire businessman.
He didn't even get a degree, did he? And he's also a monopolist. It's quite clear he used dirty tricks in the same way as the Rockefeller family did to take over the oil industry, to take over the computer operating system industry, Windows.
Well, he was basically allowed to do that by the deep state in the US.
Anyway, the big take home from the test is the red phase partial lift, which is what it looks like we may be getting on Monday, the 11th of May, the bank holiday. Which means, and let's see how accurate our prediction from 2 weeks ago is, and the Daily Mirror's, small non-residential shops may be allowed to reopen, hairdressers, warehouses, nurseries, and travel is possible but discouraged, which I don't imagine is going to be all that much different to the way it is today. A lot of this, of course, Martin, has really been about sort of self-policing. What do you make about that, the idea that people have been afraid? In fact, it seems to me the mass media has been used to actually terrify people with some of its fake news and actually inaccurate reporting, and that people the idea is that people would just, rather than just obey the law, is just simply stay at home in fear rather than go out at all.
Well, I think there's been generally a good response to the lockdown proposals that have been made. And I think in actual fact, the government are out of step with popular opinion. If they release, if we have a release in the lockdown and then we have another spike in infections, then we'll have to lock down even tighter. So it's better, in my view, to have a reasonable lockdown. For example, you could ease certain things. I mean, people, as I can see in Bristol, pretty much using the parks openly. And that you may say, well, okay, well, let's do that because we're possibly not going to come out of this lockdown for years. So if we're going to do it for years, we've got to make it bearable.
And this is where Sweden will say that they are scoring, because by allowing young people to catch the virus who aren't at danger from it, they're actually making it so that there is a very unlikely to be any kind of second wave or second spike in Sweden. Anyway, thanks to our guests. That's Labour councillor for Froom Vale, Nicola Bowden-Jones, who had to go about three quarters of the way through there, and we couldn't reconnect with her. So join us after some music as we take our weekly look around the world.